then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 4th, 1914. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, before I get going this week, I'd like to mention something that happened a few days ago. I was contacted by email by a reporter from a major news outlet, and I won't mention which one, but we're talking serious mainstream here, in that anything I said to them that got published would be read and or heard by millions of people. It was an opportunity I would really love to have taken advantage of, but I had to turn them down. It became obvious that they were not interested in me or my books or the Northwest Front or the Northwest Migration. What they wanted was for me to talk about something called Aryan Fest, a skinhead rock concert, which by now will have already taken place outside Boise, Idaho. Unless, of course, the regime found some way to shut it down. I don't know. I haven't been following it. It was obvious that what they were looking for was somebody with what I suppose you might call movement street cred to badmouth skinheads and skinhead rock. I presume this is because, even if they never respond, media people or somebody in the power structure do, in fact, listen to Radio Free Northwest, and they've heard me comment on some of my opinions about skinhead rock music in general, which, by the by, is not at all negative. I just wish that some of those skinhead rockers could have access to the kind of equipment and sound recording and mixing gear and studios and general production and infrastructure that every major Jew record company provides. But getting back on topic, what this mainstream media reporter was looking for was someone to badmouth skinheads, and that I declined to do, although I'm flattered that she would think I have enough street cred or whatever so that my opinion would be newsworthy. I finally concluded our exchange with a polite and pleasant email wherein I told her, "The Northwest Front is not a skinhead group. I don't know anything about the skinhead scene, and I don't know anything about this Aryan Fest, and so I can't comment on any of it. If, however, you ever want to do a story on the Northwest Imperative, on my Northwest novels, or the Northwest Front, then I'm your guy. Please check out www.northwestfront.org and get back to me if ever you're interested." Needless to say, I haven't heard a peep out of her since. It's the Rachel Maddow thing again. Some editor or somebody with power obviously told this reporter woman, "We do not allow these people to be publicized. Shut it down." I'm surprised she even contacted me at all to try and get me to badmouth skinheads. Okay, let's start with a few leftovers from last week's podcast. As you know, over the past few months, I've been predicting that America is just about to get hit with a 1-2 punch of double disaster. First of all, Barack Hussein Obama is going to be, quote-unquote, re-elected, if that is the word. Secondly, there is the impending Jewish assault on Persia, which will start a war which will quickly spiral out of control and cut off at least 1/3 of the Western world's imported petroleum, at a time when the United States economy, for one, simply can't take any more head-on impacts like that. I genuinely do believe that for the first time in my lifetime, there is a for real chance that the balloon may really be about to go up. Now, there are those who disagree with me on both of these issues, which is fine. Maybe they're right. Unlike most right-wing doomsayers, I don't claim to be a prophet or have any kind of inside information. I don't claim to be speaking for aliens from Alpha Centauri, and yes, we've even had that. Any of you guys out there remember Bo Greitz and the Populist Party and the Galactic Messenger Hatton in the rain and the dark in the Sheraton parking lot? Don't ask. Now, regarding the possible election results, this is an email that I got from James Z, and once again, I apologize, but I can't recall where Comrade James is from. Dear HAC, listening to the latest podcast, I'm going to stick my neck out and predict that Mittens might just win. I favor him 6-5 or so. The mainstream media are saying that he can't win loudly enough because they know it will deter some Romney voters. They just hope it's enough. At this stage in 1980, they were predicting a close election, but that Jimmy Carter would probably win by a nose. Not 76, but 80. Reagan steamrollered the hapless bastard. Romney will be almost as bad a president, of course. Anyway, what can you do? Signed, James. I'll talk about the election in a minute, but secondly, over this past week, I should also mention that there have been a number of very official-looking media stories on the Persian thing, which have all the hallmarks of official pronouncements laying out a narrative. For what it's worth, this seems to be the consensus of official media opinion now, that Benjamin Netanyahu has been talked down off the ledge, and nah, we don't have anything to worry about, there ain't gonna be no unprovoked attack on Iran. Nothing to see here. Everybody turn your faces back to the election dog and pony show. They let Benny give a nice speech at the UN with his stupid little diagram with the bomb and the red line, and that'll do the trick. Possibly more importantly, there was also a long article in last week's Newsweek about how Benny was bluffing and there won't really be an attack. And Newsweek, under this regime, is about the rough equivalent of Pravda under the old Soviet Union. And so I take it now that the official attitude of the United States power structure is that this crazy kike Netanyahu has been brought to heel and that he won't be allowed to destroy the world. Well, maybe. It could be that maybe Netanyahu staged the whole thing as a tantrum to try and force the United States into attacking Iran for him. Now remember, Benny really does want a war. He just wants the U.S. to start it and take the blame for the subsequent world disaster and misery. Now, maybe Netanyahu has received some kind of vague promise from Obongo, or rather from his Jewish and Democrat handlers, that America will attack Persia in a joint exercise with Israel at some later date. This would be after Netanyahu was finally let in on the little secret that Obongo's re-election is assured, and this whole presidential campaign performance is nothing but smoke and mirrors, so he needs to quit wasting his time schmoozing with Mitt Romney and the neocons because they ain't coming back. But presuming that the objective of all this sound and fury is to stop the Iranian nuclear program, what about all that military intel, which indicates that the Persians are digging like a bunch of lunatic gophers, and that by spring all of their nuclear toys will be so deeply buried underground that any bombing raid at all will be pointless? The super Zionists and their flacks on talk radio and at Fox News do have one point. Things have reached the point where, for the West not to attack now, means that the powers that be have tacitly accepted a nuclear Iran. Now, do we think that the world power establishment is really ready to do this? Except so-called ragheads who actually believe in something besides money as equals and give them a seat at the table? I kind of doubt it. I say again, Benjamin Netanyahu isn't bluffing about one thing. He really does want a war, but it's not a limited war just to bomb a few holes out in the Persian wasteland to destroy a bunch of machinery. Netanyahu and Israel want a war in order to destroy Persia as a nation, and especially to cripple Shia Islam, the most spiritually powerful version, not like those tame Sunnis and Ismailis and Saudis who can be bought off. They want to turn Iran into a client regime like they left behind in Iraq, ruled by a sock puppet like Karzai in Afghanistan, and they don't care how many millions of people die or suffer in the process. Now, the thing is, Israel understands that they can't fight a nation the size and power of Persia on their own. They have to get the Goyim to do it for them, just like us dumb goys fought World War II for them. The question from their point of view is, how do they do that? Do they accept Barry's promises and hope he or whoever is running him decides to keep them after the election? That's probably the Jewish international billionaire George Soros, by the way, among others. Would Soros' enterprises be hurt or benefit by a massive Persian war? That will be the key element in deciding what happens. The fact that such a war may well destroy Western civilization through the sudden loss of the necessary energy to maintain a technological and mechanical lifestyle will not bother Soros one whit. The only concern will be how it affects his own personal wealth. By the way, it has also been suggested that the real point of this whole exercise from Israel's point of view is not to blow up the Persians' nuclear toys, but to start a really huge, major war which will give Israel the excuse to finally complete what they began in the year 1948 and drive the Palestinians completely out of their own country into Jordan, Lebanon, and Egypt. Or maybe not even Jordan, since in the eyes of Zionist lunatics, Jordan is supposed to be part of the so-called Greater Israel. A war would certainly give Netanyahu an excuse to round up millions of Palestinians and load them up into trucks and take them out into the desert and dump them somewhere, alive or dead, which has always been a major aim of Israeli policy. And by the by, how many of you guys out there actually know what the symbolism of the Israeli flag means? The Star of David is obvious, but what about the two blue lines, one above and one below it? They stand for the two Middle Eastern rivers that the Jews believe should by rights constitute the boundaries of Israel, the Nile and the Euphrates. In other words, what Israel really wants is to expel the Muslims from all of Jordan, about half of Iraq, and about half of Egypt. Westerners don't know these things because our media don't allow us to know them. The Arabs know it, of course. They've known for centuries what the Jews really want. What the hell do you think all the trouble is really about over there? Now, moving on to the election, I hope that James Z is right, but the omens are not good. Last week, a Pennsylvania federal judge, a Democrat appointee, surprise, surprise, issued an injunction forbidding the state of Pennsylvania from enforcing the state's new photo ID law for voters. This means that on November the 6th, hundreds of thousands of niggers and illegal aliens are going to line up at the polls in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Scranton and Erie, voting again and again and again and again and again for Barack Hussein Obama. That's Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes gone blue again. Now, you may recall that in 2008, Pennsylvania was where the new Black Panthers in Philly and Pittsburgh and Scranton drove white voters away from the polls with force and violence, thus making sure that Obama got those 20 electoral votes, and the nigger Attorney General, Eric Holder, flat out refused to so much as open a file for a civil rights investigation, openly stating that his so-called Justice Department would not investigate voter intimidation aimed at whites. The Huffington Post website was running a little map of their own on how they expect the Electoral College to go. Obama won, of course. I just checked the site, and it doesn't seem to be there anymore, but basically they showed the West Coast, including Oregon and Washington, and above all, California, with its massive 55 electoral votes, as blue, and New England and the Midwest with Texas red and Florida up in the air. I just checked the site, and it doesn't seem to be there anymore, but basically they showed the West Coast, including Oregon and Washington, and above all California with its massive 55 electoral votes, to be blue. It showed New England and the Midwest as blue as well, with Texas red and Florida up in the air, and Obongo still came out ahead. Even if they write off Florida, which actually may go blue now with all the snowbirds there who have died since 2008 and the growing number of niggers and illegals down there, the Democrats can still win with California, Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and two or three other smaller states like Minnesota with 10 electoral votes, Indiana with 11, Washington with 12. Damn, Seattle's even bigger than I thought it was. James, you may be right. I hope you're right. It could well be that with one last mighty effort, like that of a wounded animal just before it perishes, the Republican Party will be able to drag enough aging white people out to the polls on November the 6th and beat back the massive Democrat vote fraud sufficiently and somehow get some kind of an honest vote count from the Diebold Corporation and maybe grab back the White House for another 4 years. That's the last 4 years they will ever hold it. By 2016, more white people will have died of old age, there will be more niggers and more illegal aliens who have snuck onto the voter rolls, and Hillary will probably make her move so she'll get millions of stupid white women to vote for her. And by the way, this also assumes that the votes will be counted honestly in the first place, which I very much doubt. The simple fact is, James, that normal white people are now outnumbered at the polls, especially under the existing Electoral College system. By 2020, we will be outnumbered, in fact, throughout the entire North American continent. Now, I'll talk about the practical aspects of that later. Right now, let's have a little incitement to violence and armed insurrection against the government of the United States. This is Carl Klang.
woke up one day with nothing much to do. He tried to put his street clothes on but couldn't find his shoe. The night before he tied one on, now cobwebs filled his head. By afternoon he called in sick and then went back to bed. The next day he felt shaky but he made it off to work and voted to increase his pay and take another perk. Although the people cried out loud and told him what to do, instead of trying to cut the cost, he increased revenue. Yippee-yi-yo! Off their hide. My congressman just voted yes to increase foreign aid. Although our nation's infrastructure's worn and torn and frayed, while veterans and nation sons become the unemployed, since NAFTA those aliens will gladly fill the void. Yippee-yi-yo! Use old-fashioned justice and go out and get a rope and hang 'em high. My senator just voted yes to pass the Brady Bill. He thinks if he can take my guns, it's him that won't be killed. He doesn't give a hang about the crime he helps create. As long as bribes keep coming in, Americans can wait. Yippee-yi-yo! Use old-fashioned justice. Go out and get a rope and hang 'em high. Check 'em out, size 'em up, hook 'em up, pipe 'em out. If they're in, vote 'em out. If they're out, hunt 'em down. Drag 'em into the court, every trade or a sword. Use your vote like a rope, hang 'em high. Hang 'em high. Yeah.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman to spy on the Steele family before any of this came up. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that gold and silver, about $45,000 worth, seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire, which appeared even to a layman who first heard them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to tell the court that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive at trial and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't do him much good. Last month, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. McAllister is also in his 60s, and so I suppose it's only poetic justice that he should die in living hell just like the client he abandoned. But for whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons who were present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed off somebody really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had withdrawn from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is now being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal prison system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Steele is also being held incommunicado. My mail to him started being returned this week after being held for months. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. As nearly as I can determine, no one has physically heard from Ed for some months now. He may be dead already. It is time that Edgar Steele's voice was heard once again in the land, if for no other reason than because the FBI and the Obama regime don't want you to hear it. This is an interview which was recorded in prison about 11 months ago on November the 3rd, 2011. So far as I have been able to determine, it may be the last time anyone on the outside was allowed access to Steele and the last time he was allowed to speak in public. This is just part of the interview. I will try to get the rest of it for future podcasts.
You've never been in trouble. You've never been in jail before. You've never had any serious, you know, any run-ins with the law. It's a complete lifestyle change. I mean, how do you adjust to something like that? And has it gotten any easier?
It depends upon what you mean by easier. Do you get used to it? The human being is remarkably adaptable. You get used to anything. Kids kept in basements in cardboard boxes for 6 years, the first thing they want to do is crawl back in the cardboard box. Now, I don't want to go back to my cell, so I'm not quite that far gone. But it is a lifestyle change. I've never done anything wrong, including this case, incidentally. And I don't deserve this. I've led an exemplary life, what I thought was a truly successful and admirable life, what everybody else thinks is and has been as well. To be here is a shock, an injustice of the first order. I am up close and personal dealing with the tyranny and the corruption that I have warned America about through my writings and through the cases I've handled for 30 years of a legal career as a trial lawyer.
And now that you're facing it and you're experiencing it every day, I guess it's probably hard to say what it feels like when it's...
Well, you know, it's kind of ironic because I always thought I'd like to end my career with one big case of involving real government tyranny and genuine wrongdoing that you could point to, and people would be marching in the streets. And lo and behold, ironically, I've almost got that case, and it's mine. Unfortunately, when you're in jail, you don't have an opportunity to work on your case. I've had to leave it in the hands of other people. You think to yourself, well, I've heard about these law libraries that they have in jails and prisons, and geez, the machines they have. No, nothing. Here's our law library. See those three boxes? They just delivered it the other day. That's a current, well, last year's issue of the Idaho codes. The old codes are about 8 years old. They're inside that cabinet there. The law library is useless. I can't do a thing for myself here.
Are you comfortable with, I know that there's been issues with the counsel that you had representing you. Are you comfortable with the counsel that you have now representing you?
Yes, Wes Hoyt's an excellent lawyer. He's a true believer, I call it. And I wish I'd had him from the beginning. Hopefully we'll get a new trial and he'll get a chance to show what the case really is.
When you're in your cell, are you by yourself?
I've got a cellmate in there right now. It varies. They run people through there.
Do your cellmates know who you are?
Some do. I don't make a point of it. I try to duck the question if they ask me. And there's kind of an unwritten rule is that you don't ask somebody what they're in for. You can ask them how long they've been in, how long they expect to be in, but you're not supposed to talk about their case. Being a snitch is one of the big things in jail and prison. And it's so easy to get people to start thinking of you as a snitch if you're taking too much personal interest in their legal affairs.
Isolating, to say the least, your experience so far.
Yes, that's the point of solitary confinement, which is how I was held for the first year that I was incarcerated.
Let's go back to your case first, because I know, I mean, there's a lot to go with, but that's the very beginning. Obviously, serious accusations, and the jury believed the accusations.
Well, they didn't hear any defense. They didn't have any choice. The judge, I know how this sounds, the judge literally did not allow me to put on a defense. My key expert witnesses were excluded while they were able to put on anything they wanted. The documentary evidence was selectively presented to the jury to make it look one way when it really was another way. I didn't testify on the advice of my lawyer, who definitely didn't want me to testify. And I was in no mental frame of mind to testify either, but he hadn't even prepared me anyway. I couldn't have testified if I'd had to. Of course, he didn't prepare anybody. He was just there for the money, flying low, quick to get out.
Your expert witness was going to testify about, was it the validity of those audio recordings?
Yes. There were two of them, actually. Two renowned world experts on audio recordings. One, a forensic linguist, the forensic linguist, the number one authority, the guy who literally wrote the book, George Papson. And the other guy was a guy named Walsh, Dennis Walsh, who had worked with the New York Police Department for over 25 years analyzing sound recordings and now runs a company that analyzes sound recordings. The judge wouldn't let either one of them come into trial and testify. If he had, he would have heard Dr. Papsen say that the recordings are so unreliable that they shouldn't even be listened to. If he had listened to Walsh, he would have heard even further, because Walsh pointed out that the voice on the two recordings, in many cases, wasn't even mine. And that, yes, it was a cut-and-paste job. He identified well over 300 places of what he called anomalies, of the sort that occur when you splice tapes together, take gaps out. And the second guy, 25 years, New York PD. Oh, incidentally, Dr. Papsen does a lot of work for the FBI, I might add. So he didn't have a bias for me. Walsh was testifying that it wasn't even my voice on those two tapes most of the time. Somebody else's voice that had been electronically morphed into mine. I heard the tapes. We never recognize our own voices when we hear a recording. And I was physically sickened for a week the first time I heard the tapes. I knew it wasn't me, but it sounded like me. I mean, geez, what's going on here? My wife, unbeknownst to me, because they established I couldn't even talk to my wife for a year. They put up a no-contact order. So I couldn't find out what was going on in my case through my wife, of all people. She listened to the tapes once, and she knew it wasn't me. You know, if I had known that at the beginning, it would have been comforting, at least.
So your contention is not, because you talk about that it wasn't your voice, and then you talk about that it was cut and pasted. Mm-hmm. I mean, is the cut and paste job, is that your voice from something else?
There are segments on there where I recognize the topic, and I recognize the phrasing. And yes, I say things like that. And those, I think, probably are me. And that's what Walsh says, that lots of them are. And he went through and identified some sections. I did some independently. They kind of matched up. Okay? Where he said it wasn't me. Because you can identify voice wave analysis electronically, a particular voice. And where he said it wasn't me, I didn't say things like that. I didn't even talk like that. It just wasn't normal for me.
Where would they get the recordings of you for the things that were you?
Well, they're readily available. I decided, based on some of the snippets that I had heard, that there had been recordings made surreptitiously by this oafish handyman that we had, Fairfax, who's the guy who's the self-admitted perp. Okay, here we got a case with no victim, no damage, and we've got a confessed perp serving his time in jail, and they want to lay 60 years on me. What's wrong with that picture? There's something else going on. They called me the million-dollar man down at the Coeur d'Alene District Federal Courthouse. That was the marshals and the staff because of the extraordinary amount of money they were spending on putting me away. Why? If this just was an ordinary run-of-the-mill murder-for-hire case, which incidentally is the very kind of case that the FBI repeatedly gets accused of fabricating against people. Repeatedly. I ain't the first. I am not going to be the last. If it was just that, why all these resources? It's a trivial thing. No victim, no damage. There's no complaining victim in my case. None. Nobody got hurt. My wife is my biggest supporter. She knows better. Anybody who knows me knows better. But we got this oafish North Idaho handyman who claims that I hired him to kill my wife. Okay? And there were several reasons that were advanced as motive, and there were even three reasons advanced at trial. Let the jury take their pick, I guess.
So you think he had recorded you on other occasions?
Thanks for reminding me of that. I wandered so much that I lost. I was trying to pick up that thread. Yeah, I think that he had been recording me surreptitiously on occasion. But there are thousands of hours of me talking on the internet that anybody can download.
What's Larry Fairfax's motive here, do you think? To record you, to set you up, if that's the accusation?
Well, no, as a cover-up. It's the oldest motive known to man, greed. He stole silver from us. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know the silver was missing. I had silver in stashes on my property that I thought were safe. I had them split up so that there wouldn't be any danger of it being found by somebody all at once. But the FBI told me that I'd paid him in silver, which is when it came to me, what's going on? And that's how I first made the connection. I had my son then go check the silver stashes I had in some outlying buildings on the property. And the three that I told him to check were all gone. And Larry Fairfax knew about them. He knew that I had stashes. He had built some of them for me. I trusted him. Okay? So my son of course, I've been in the house in bed most of the time for the last 6 months, keep in mind. Larry's been coming by every day to feed the horses and do minor things. I never suspected there was anything missing. It wasn't until after I was sitting in a jail cell, max solitary, you know, that I finally put it together and had my son check. And yes, we had $45,000 of silver at that price at that time that was missing. That's now worth, at today's price, over $100,000. And Larry gets to keep it. Snitches always get to keep it. The FBI does that by way of paying them. But they also paid Larry in this case, too, another time. This is an interesting case, even though there are a lot of trite aspects to it. What makes the aspects trite is that they've been done again and again and again, and you keep hearing about them. And you sit out there in the real world and you think, well, geez, that's... there's got to be a reason for this. I mean, the guy wouldn't be on trial if he wasn't guilty, would he? Well, what do you think we have trials for anyway? But that is the attitude people have, especially jurors. And just because something is trite doesn't mean it doesn't occur. My case is convoluted in a couple of ways. I don't think it deserves a made-for-TV movie treatment, frankly. I mean, it's ordinary in that regard, but it is very predictable. He stole silver from us, wanted to cover up, wanted to kill me. He put car bombs, he admitted putting car bombs on the two cars I drive, one of which my wife drove about half the time, the other one I drove exclusively. He admitted he took one bomb off, and he thought he testified that the other bomb had fallen off somewhere. So then he apparently shifted gears, and the gear was to get me thrown in jail to get me out of the way. And boy, he did it. I had told him about my difficulties politically with the ADL, with the SPLC, with the FBI. He knew about all this. All he had to do was make one phone call in order to be drafted into a scheme to put me down.
You're giving Larry Fairfax a lot of credit for brains.
I don't mean...
Oafish as well.
I don't mean to do that. He's shrewd like a weasel. Okay? Not real bright, but shrewd and conniving. I think you know the difference. But he couldn't have done this by himself. He didn't manufacture those tapes. There's no question in my mind. Somebody had to. Somebody with resources and expertise.
Okay, a few quick comments. The appeal filed by attorney Wes Hoyt, which Ed refers to in the preceding segment, was turned down by the Supreme Court without comment. They wouldn't even hear it, much less grant a new trial. I'm also attempting to ascertain exactly when was the last time anybody actually physically heard from Edgar Steele, either by letter or by email. Now, I understand that when he was first admitted to Victorville, he was given access to something called CarLinks, which is a prison email system. I've written to Ed at both addresses for the prison in Adelanto, California, giving him the two email addresses for which I have CoreLink's accounts, and I've received no reply, although those letters are not among the mail that's been returned so far from either address. Normally, I would ask the official Edgar Steele website, but there's not much actual information on Steele himself since his conviction, and also apparently there is some problem there in communicating with the NF, because we are wicked and evil radical extremists, and any contact with us might, quote-unquote, mess up Edgar's case and get the federal authorities all pissed off so they'll take it out on him. Guys, got a newsflash for you. 67-year-old man with a serious heart condition, fabricated evidence and perjury on the witness stand, prosecutorial misconduct, judicial corruption, 50-year sentence in a prison with poisoned water, appeal rejected by the Supreme Court without comment. I don't think the tyrant can get any more pissed off with Edgar Steele than he already is. Now, the Prison Bureau locator on the internet still shows him at Victorville last time I checked, although they may be giving him what's known in the prison system as diesel therapy. Constant transfers to keep a prisoner disoriented and demoralized and keep him away from his friends and his supporters, and above all, keep him away from his legal counsel. That may be what's happening. I have no idea. If any of you listeners out there have had any direct contact with Edgar Steele over the summer, please let me know the date. We are living more and more in 1984. And in Orwell's Oceania, people do tend to become unpersons. So if you know anything about Ed, if you know whether he's still alive and kicking, please let me hear from you. Now some music by request. This is the Agnus Dei Mass by the composer William Byrd, and this is for Mike in South Carolina.
comrades. Tonight I would like to talk to you about a book that I had to read back when I was in high school. I found it really interesting, and it was really somewhat of a benchmark for me in terms of racial awareness. And that was this book called The Light in the Forest by Conrad Richter. And it's about a certain aspect of American history that I haven't read very much about, but this was something that actually did happen. And it dealt with white people that became adopted by Native Americans. And the story is about a young man who gets adopted. He lives in the Pennsylvania area, and at a very young age, he's captured and adopted by this tribe. And he lives with them and really becomes very enthusiastic about this new identity that he has, and then ends up having to go back home. And he really struggles with his identity. He struggles with issues of loyalty. Who should he be loyal to? And, of course, this story is set back at a time when there was real race war going on between Indians and white. And eventually, he finds that he remains loyal to the white race. And yet, he really does struggle. And he sees both sides. So you can't say that he's really biased, but eventually, biology wins out. Now, this was something that really happened. I did a little research, and apparently this happened a lot, particularly in New England. Sometimes people were captured. Sometimes there were cases of miscegenation, but not always. And sometimes the people that were captured actually wanted to meet with other white captives. And honestly, it seems that they were treated fairly well. There were many of them that would try to move back to white society, but they had a hard time adjusting, and in many cases never fully adjusted. Oftentimes, these people were thought of as being either maybe Indian or partially Indian by whites, who would get very confused about what their identity was. Sometimes people who think they have Native American ancestry may actually have a person that was merely adopted. And so when they go to have a DNA test, they find they don't really have any Indian genes. It's just that someone got adopted many years ago. So I just thought I'd talk about this because it's a very interesting phenomenon. It actually happened to Patty Hearst in fairly recent history. And if you do get adopted by a tribe, the tribes take it fairly seriously beyond the rolls, and you have an ID number, and they may like you to pay dues and so forth. And, you know, I have to say many tribes are pretty poor. One of the characters in this book, by the way, is he has an uncle that when I was in class and having to read this book and discuss it, many people didn't like his uncle, but his uncle was a very proud white in the story. And honestly, you know, I walk around outside my home, I go outside and I realize, you know, I'm walking around, I'm unarmed, and but this is a very safe place to live now. It wasn't always that way. There was a time when even, well, all parts of the United States were really pretty wild. I'm really quite thankful to all the white men that made it so habitable and such an easy place to live. And I'd also like to thank right now all the construction workers, because today is Thank a Tradesman Day, or actually when I'm recording this it is. I don't know when you'll hear it, but I often think about all the infrastructure we have and the road systems and the supermarkets and all of that. And honestly, while certainly the Indians, for example, lived a much greener life, and they didn't have the carbon footprint that we do, I'm thankful for all the innovations that make life so much easier. You know, I'm thankful to live in a house, for example, and I'm not exposed to things like dampness or mold. And I really know that I couldn't survive, for example, trying to live in a wigwam or something. I mean, I've seen exhibits near where I live, and I know that it would be very tough to live in one of those things because it would be very moldy, for example. If you have any kind of allergies, I mean, just forget it. You couldn't survive. You'd have the asthma attack of your life or your death, and that would be that. So I'm really, really thankful for all that I have in this society. You know, we can say what we will about, I guess, white males and so forth. I'm very grateful for all the infrastructure and all the safety that I have. So thank you for listening, and hopefully I'll soon finish that book I'm reading. But The Arctic Home of the Vedas is a very wordy book, as many books by the Asian Indians often are. So I'm working my way through it quite slowly, and so I thought I'd talk to you about this really interesting book that I read. And actually, at the end of the day, I think it's a very pro-white book, and I'm surprised they let us read it back when I was in junior high. It's a quick read. It's kind of a short book, but I think it's very nice, really. So thank you for listening to my review, okay? I'm always looking for new things to talk about on this show. So thank you very much.
There's something else I meant to talk about last week, but which I didn't get around to. Now, you know how it is when I start rambling on here. The original question last week, as I recall, was how will white Americans react when Obongo is reelected? Now, by the by, I assume that I don't have to explain that when I use the term Americans on here, I mean white Americans. Non-whites can be American niggers or American Indians or South American mestizos, but they cannot be Americans in the same sense that we are, any more than an Asian or a Somali Kaffir can. A piece of paper issued by whatever turd is sitting on the throne in some Washington, D.C. bureaucracy doesn't make someone an American. Being an American is a discrete ethnic identity restricted to those who actually made this country as opposed to those who have done nothing but take from it. And it is unique to the Caucasian race. Anyway, what will Americans learn when Barry is reelected by whatever combination of vote fraud and benefit bribery and electoral college razzle-dazzle the Democrats decide to employ? I'm sorry to say that most of them won't learn anything at all. They'll just hang their heads and snuffle and shuffle back off to their sofas to see who's on Dancing with the Stars tonight. I have already told you that we can give up any idea that our racial nation will ever be established by any kind of Weimar Germany NSDAP type of mass movement. Different time, different place, and above all, different people. Not happening here and not happening now. We just plain don't have the human material to work with. But let's talk about the 5-10% of our racial brothers and sisters who still do have a few brain cells to rub together. What they will learn, finally, once and for all, is a lesson I think the more intelligent among the white American population have suspected for some time, but which they probably have never dared to say out loud, that lesson being that democracy doesn't work. Now, from this point on, the more perceptive and intelligent among us will have to understand and accept that our people have no more hope within the system, because, as Rush Limbaugh says, the takers now outnumber the makers. Now, let me repeat this yet again. Burn it into your brains. From now on, white people are a minority in this country, all of it. Not because the actual population statistics say so, although we're getting there as more and more of us die off and fewer of us are born every year, but because thanks to the antiquated and now lethally dangerous electoral college system of selecting a president, we are forever outnumbered at the polls. As I said earlier, if the votes are counted honestly this time around, it's just possible that the Republicans might be able to drag enough aging white people to the polls, many of them no doubt hobbling on canes and walkers and being pushed in wheelchairs, to vote GOP one last time and put them over the top so they can grab the White House for one last four-year stint. But I still don't think it's going to play out that way. Limbaugh and his kind are getting very skittish about these clearly rigged polls. They claim it's because the Democrats are trying to demoralize white people and suppress Romney's turnout because Americans have no moral stamina and are basically very weak and timid people. And Democrats know this. After all, we haven't revolted against the Democrats yet, have we? Americans have a tendency to give up on lost causes because they get all depressed and moan and sob into their beer instead of committing a perfectly legal act to try and do something about it, as I, of all people, can tell you from my own experience over the past 10 years. But it's not just that. I think the Democrats are rigging up all these bogus polls to prepare us all for a result that just doesn't make sense, i.e. Obama's re-election. Not for any president to be re-elected after having made this kind of total fuck-up of the country for the past 4 years is simply beyond the bounds of credibility, if there is any kind of honest vote total. It looks like liberals are setting up some kind of really major vote fraud, probably on the same level as the Acorn fraud that put Obama in back in 2008. Now, if they can succeed in getting around these photo ID for voters laws in a couple of other states, like they've done in Pennsylvania, they can probably pull it off through using the old Tammany Hall Mayor Daley tactic of simply voting repeaters and dead people. Remember, a city can carry a state, and that state has electoral votes that can put a nigger back into power. But let's get back to the central question. What will white people do when Obongo wins and we face 4 more years, possibly more if he decides to get rid of the 22nd Amendment or simply ignore it? Anyway, at least 4 more years of being ruled by an ignorant and, in my view, unstable third world despot, who may or may not be fully in the control of his handlers. Bear in mind the part of the world that Barack Hussein Obama comes from. We could well end up with Idi Amin in the White House once he is free of any need to worry about re-election or any other kind of accountability. Now, most white people will, of course, do nothing. They'll run away. They will retreat into introspection and mysticism, or else into extreme hobbies or onto the internet, of course. They will never actually resist, since the genetic codes that would trigger actual physical resistance seem to have been successfully bred out of white Americans, or at least the majority of them. If not bred out, then so badly smothered and paralyzed that they're virtually useless. I think one of the reasons I'm having such difficulty getting white people to come here and settle a homeland, despite the fact that it's a perfectly legal and actually beneficial act once you get over the initial hurdles, I think one of the reasons I'm having so many problems is that I'm appealing to something that's no longer there, except in a tiny minority of our people who are what's called in science atavisms, throwbacks to an earlier genotype or evolutionary model. I'm not talking about mere cowardice or laziness or timidity or confusion, although God knows we got enough of that. I'm saying that in the overwhelming majority of American white people, the very idea of actual physical resistance against what is being done to them by the United States government and by the American ruling class simply will not occur to them at all, because they no longer have the chromosomal software to configure the concept, so to speak. Computers function very much like the human brain, and you might say that with most white people, trying to form any plan or even idea of actual physical resistance, I mean, really doing it, really fighting against the government, is like trying to launch a program that's been deleted. The necessary codes and processes simply aren't there on your hard drive anymore. But what about the tiny number of white people who do still have the necessary mental and spiritual software? Are these the ones that I try to reach with this podcast? I'm hoping that if I click on the mouse enough times, so to speak, the program will respond. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and take our third music break right now. Last week, I got a very good response when I featured the old Irish folk group Clannad as our musical guest, so much so that I got requests for more. This is Mari Brennan singing Bukalanern. Smentae er hongdae you. Okay, I'm going to get into a question, or rather a series of questions here, that impinge a little on some pretty sketchy ground. Not only because the whole thing is highly speculative, but because it's the kind of speculation that sets the antennae of the insects in the silk suits who are listening all aquiver. Yes, this is conjecture that wanders onto some dangerous ground, but I long ago decided that I will not allow these people to make me afraid to speak. That's what they want to do with crap like the Edgar Steele case, to make Americans afraid to think and afraid to speak. It's institutional terrorism, not of the bin Laden kind, but of the Stalin kind, the kind that Alexander Solzhenitsyn spent his entire life opposing. Indeed, Obama himself is known to be an admirer of Stalin, as witness his association with people like Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, and Jeremiah Wright. Solzhenitsyn survived Stalin in the Gulag, and I just have to hope I'll survive whatever Obama and the FBI throw at me, or at least my work will. So speak I shall. I've gotten a couple of versions in recent months of the same question, and that is, Harold, in your opinion, what could set it off? The quote-unquote real thing. How will it begin? I can't answer that question fully because there are so many possibilities. Off the top of my head, I can think of half a dozen scenarios as to how the real thing might start. On reflection, though, I think it will require three basic conditions to be met, just like fire has to have heat, oxygen, and fuel to burn. The first requirement is that the central government in Washington, D.C. has to be sufficiently weak and decayed so that resistance will become possible and won't be immediately crushed. Or, perhaps a more positive and upbeat way to say it, would be that the independence movement in the Northwest will have to be sufficiently strong and badass so that the central government in D.C. cannot immediately crush it with the resources right at hand. The second condition I can't specify exactly, but there has to be a straw that breaks the camel's back. An event or person or act of the regime that serves as a motivator, a stressor, as profilers say when they're talking about serial killers, pardon the comparison. Something that pushes a man or an entire community or a whole nation over the edge to the point where they just plain don't give a damn anymore about whatever consequences may result from resistance. White people in the Northwest have to reach a place where they would rather die than live one more day under the rule of Barack Hussein Obama and his political correctness. Now, I have no idea when or how such a stressor will occur for the white people of the Pacific Northwest, but history teaches us that indefinite tyranny and oppression simply is not possible, that at some point, somewhere along the line, something has to give. Someday, something will give here in the Northwest. The third condition is kind of hard for me to describe. I know what I want to say, but I'm just not sure how to explain it. The primary weapon that this society has always deployed against normal white people to keep them in line and crush any dissent is money, and somehow they have to lose that. Money must become no good anymore. Now, that could happen in any number of ways, most likely, in my opinion, because about 18 months to 2 years into his second term, Obama and the liberals and the Democrats will literally run out of money. They won't be able to tax or borrow or steal anymore. George Soros himself will cut Obama off, and so the Democrats will have no choice but to tell the Jew Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve to let them print and presses roll, leading to hyperinflation and $135,000 Happy Meals at McDonald's. Now that's one way. Or the rising cost of everything due to the loss of one-third of the Western world's imported petroleum when Benny Netanyahu breaks loony and bombs Persia. That could mean that you can't buy anything with the money you're paid because everything just costs too damn much. Now, the main thing is that the Americans must no longer be able to pay their mercenaries, the muscle men who keep them in power, who protect the pale things in the suits from the consequences of their own behavior. I'm talking about the militarized police and SWAT teams who have been loaded up with machine guns and armored cars and body armor and indoctrinated by the SPLC. I'm talking about the steroid-pumped highway patrol and cops who bulk up like Arnold Schwarzenegger to intimidate people while their brains are fried and their testicles shrink to the size of pencil erasers because of the damn drugs they take. I'm talking about the FBI and DHS and ATF agents in their aviator shades and silk suits and all the various other spooks who make their livings spying on people and figuring out ways to avoid that pesky Constitution which keeps telling them what they can't do. Now, let me ask you something. I'm dead serious here. Think about this. How long do you think these assholes in the suits and the air-conditioned offices and the limousines and the private jets who actually cause all this crap would last if they didn't have all these muscle men to protect them from the consequences of their actions and to carry out their bidding against the weak and helpless? How long do you think the muscle men will continue to work for the assholes in the suits if they're not paid, or if they're paid in worthless money, or maybe vouchers for a government PX like has already happened a couple of times? Remember, this isn't TV or the movies. These aren't television cops and FBI like Mulder and Scully or Agent Seeley Booth or Mark Harmon from NCIS we're talking about. This is the real world now. Except for a few of the more extreme buzz-cut booyahs, probably 700 club types who live in a Pat Boone fantasy world, none of these people give a rat's ass about truth, justice, and the red, white, and blue American way. Not really. In real life, American law enforcement are basically hired goons who fight for money and medical insurance. How long will they really fight for their lord and lady masters without receiving either, do you think? Not long. So, that's the third condition. The money has to be no good anymore. Beyond that, as to how it will start, I'm damned if I know. My Northwest novels present one general possibility, but there are other scenarios ranging from some kind of 7 days in May internal coup d'etat to some kind of Lexington and Concord face down somewhere out in the countryside here, to full-blown Mad Max Road Warrior shit complete with purple mohawks and crossbows. Or anything in between. Right now, at this moment, I just don't know how it'll happen. Will it happen at all? Yes. Disregard my occasional ranting and raving about extinction. Human nature, and above all Aryan nature being what it is, yes, one day it will happen. We're going to be free of America one day, folks. It's just that the ride between this day and that is going to be a real bitch. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.